First on Radio 4, Jonathan Charles has had exclusive access to a British forensic archaeology project looking for the hidden graves at the site of the former Nazi death camp at Treblinka in Poland.
If you didn't know what had happened here, this would seem idyllic. It's so peaceful, so quiet. There isn't a sound, occasionally the odd butterfly flapping its wings. I'm walking through a forest, and the forest completely covers Treblinka camp. It surrounds it, and that was the Germans' whole idea. They didn't want people to know what was going on here, so they put it in this quiet, out-of-the-way place where they thought they could keep the killing secret. And you wouldn't really know what had happened here until you come to six stones in six different languages: Polish, Hebrew, Russian, English, French, and German. And all six stones say the same thing. There was a Nazi extermination camp here between July 1942 and August 1943. More than 800,000 Jews from Poland, the Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Austria, France, Belgium, Germany and Greece were murdered. And on August 2nd, 1943, it says the prisoners organised an armed revolt which was crushed in blood by the Nazi hangmen.
For some reason, not many people have looked at these sites. Not many people have attempted to find the victims, or at least demarcate areas where they may be buried. And at first, I couldn't understand why that was, because to me, it seems obvious from a humanitarian perspective that we should be looking at these kinds of sites. If we can't pass it on to future generations, how are we going to remember what happened here in the distant future?
We came there. I was with my mother. We were about 100 people in a wagon. They were cattle wagons. And they opened the doors with shouting and swearing and firing guns and blows, and they sent us into a yard. And that is where the whole thing began.
Kalman Tegman is one of the only two remaining survivors of the Treblinka death camp. When people think of the Holocaust, it's usually Auschwitz that comes to mind. One reason for that is that the Nazis did such a good job of making sure that little physical evidence of the crimes committed against Kalman and so many others was left behind at Treblinka. Now in his late 80s, Kalman lives in Israel, but in 1942 he was transported here from Warsaw as part of Operation Reinhardt. This was the code name given to the Nazi plan to murder the Jews of Nazi-occupied Poland. The scale of the killing was unimaginable. Around 1.7 million Jews perished in camps like Treblinka. Most of them didn't know the fate that awaited them.
I ran with my mother and tried to calm her up to the gate of the yard. They told me to leave my mother and go to the right, but I didn't do it very quickly. So I was hit on the head. I fell down. And although I got up very fast, I could not see my mother anymore. She went with all the rest of the women to the gas chamber.
When you come into the centre of Treblinka camp, there's a huge open area. It is surrounded by trees now, and it's about 300 metres long, about, I don't know, 100 metres wide. And this is where all the buildings would have been, all the barracks and the gas chambers. And now there's nothing here apart from grass and 17,000 stones sticking up out of the ground. We're just walking amongst them now. They are little bits of rock, and each one represents a different village, a different town across Europe. The Jews were brought here, and the names are on some of the rocks. Konispol, Ross, Podsesi, Osiek. Places all over Europe. Each one of these 17,000 stones doesn't just represent the individuals who perished, it represents communities that have been wiped out, whole cultures that are gone forever. And that's really the only memorial that's here. Because there are no buildings here, it's all there is to remind you of the terrible atrocities, that is the only word you can use, atrocities, that occurred here.
In this particular area, we think this was where the gas chambers were,
right.
And chances are quite a lot of them were blown up for ease of demolition. And in places you can actually see there's a row of bricks we're obviously still part of a building.
So in this area where we are, you found a building here, or part of a building underneath it?
No. British forensic archaeologist Caroline Sturdy-Coles takes me on a tour of the site. She's here with her team from the University of Birmingham to confront a unique challenge, the first coordinated scientific attempt to locate the mass graves at Treblinka. If she's successful, it could have major implications for searches elsewhere. At Auschwitz, the physical evidence of the Nazi extermination methods, the gas chambers, the crematoria, are there to be seen and have been visited by millions. But at Treblinka, where almost one in six victims of the Holocaust died, that lack of the infrastructure of death is an obstacle to remembering. Caroline's hoping that by using the latest technology, she'll go some way to redress that. It's tricky, though. She has to do it all without disturbing the ground. That would be against Jewish religious law governing burial sites.
What we do is use a series of techniques. Some of them are field survey methods, simply creating a map of the camp itself. The other techniques we use in geophysics are able to look below the ground.
So what's this piece of equipment doing? We're standing in something, it's obviously reading data, isn't it?
It is. It's a ground-penetrating radar, and what it does is it sends radar pulses into the ground, which are then reflected from buried remains. And they're reflected in different ways, depending on what's actually buried under the soil. So we can detect things like pits and walls and structures.
Well, let's see it in action. Let's see it going now. So there's a long wire linking this big red box, which is being pulled along the ground and showing what the state of the ground is.
So you can see here we've got things buried quite close to the surface, and then also considerable disturbance to the rest of the ground surface. And we're seeing down...
Caroline and her team are also using archive documents from around the world, aerial photographs, satellite imagery, as well as written and oral testimonies of survivors to support her research. A tiny number of Jews survived Treblinka's death camp, around 70. One of them was Chil Rachman, transported there from Lublin in Poland in 1942. Where he was forced to work in the extermination process. His witness account, a survivor's memory, has only recently been published in English for the first time and was translated by Solon Beinfeld.
The grim freight wagons transport me there, to that place. They are transporting from all directions, from east and west, from north and south, by day and by night. In all seasons of the year, people are brought there, spring and summer, autumn and winter. The transports travel there without hindrance and without limit, and Treblinka grows richer in blood day by day. The more people who are brought there, the more Treblinka is able to receive them.
Some of those who were sent to Treblinka came from the Jewish ghetto in Warsaw. I'm just walking through it now. Most of the old buildings are gone. There's a lot of construction work going on here at the moment. Big new blocks being put up. There are a few tenements left in a rundown state, and on their windows, pictures have been put of men, women and children, Jewish parents, grandparents, young people, just to remind everyone in Warsaw of what happened. And I'm just going across the square here to see Rabbi Michael Szudryk. He's the chief rabbi of Poland, and he's had to give his permission for this work at Treblinka to be done.
The work that's going on in Treblinka right now, there was no question of convincing, because it's a very important work that's going on, is we want to know where the graves are. And it's taken way too long to do. The reason why it's only being done now, 65 plus years later, well, the simple answer is that this country was occupied by Soviet communists until 89. What's taken 21 years? There are two factors. One is that there were a lot of things that had to be fixed after 50 years of double occupation. And secondly is that there's new technology.
At the end of this, what do you think we're going to know that we don't know now?
I think we're going to know if the method works. That's the first thing we're going to know. There are graves somewhere. There are, and graves meaning both of bones and also of burnt bones. They have different compositions. This is a rather horrible thing to say in a calm voice, but that's what you need to be able to understand when you're dealing with death camps. There's a very high probability that we will be able to say, okay, well, we know that the boundaries of the mass graves are from here to there, and now we can properly map it out and properly preserve it, because there's a huge chance that right now people are walking over the mass graves just because we don't know where they are.
So tell us about this area we're coming up to now then, Caroline.
We think from a collection of witness plans and other documentary evidence, aerial photographs, that this area was called the Lazaret, and that literally translates as field hospital. And a lot of the German concentration camps and labour camps had these so-called field hospitals. In this case, it's highly unlikely to ever treated anyone. It was very much a front for the fact that behind it there were these burial pits where the weak and people who died in the transport could be buried very quickly. And also witnesses talk of an eternal flame, that there was a ever-burning pit here where rubbish and victims, sometimes alive, were thrown into this pit in this area.
Those who couldn't walk were taken to a place that was called Lazaret. It didn't mean anything. The Lazaret was just a skeleton. There was a little hut there surrounded by a fence, but it was not a building. It was simply a sort of huge, deep grave, and over it a fire burned constantly. When they brought the man who couldn't walk, first of all, they shot him. Afterwards, they threw him on the fire.
The extermination of Jews at Treblinka was often far from systematic. Chil Rachman was one of the Jews responsible for burying the bodies.
Running back and forth several times, I finally see what things look like in the deep pit. Several labourers stand in the pit, all of them Jews, and lay out the dead bodies one next to the other. That is how the work proceeds. The pit becomes more and more full. There can be no question of resting for a while, because we have to run one after the other without a break. We run back and forth. The 2 hours that pass in this way, until evening, seem like a year.
Treblinka soon became a killing machine on an industrial scale. Dr. Yitzhak Arad is a former head of the World Holocaust Center, Yad Vashem. He was a partisan in Lithuania during the war and the author of a book on Operation Reinhardt. He believes his own parents were amongst the many victims at Treblinka.
There were days when about 12,000 Jews were killed in one day. Look, from Warsaw to Treblinka were deported between July 22nd up to September 12th, were deported about 350,000 Jews. So the daily average was thousands of Jews every day from the morning till the evening.
Yes, and I see there are some pictures actually of big black and white photos, aren't there, of German officers standing around. A picture obviously from the time, presumably, standing around as they would have done, waiting in the area we're about to walk up to where the big train transports were arriving to sort out who was going which way.
Exactly. These photographs actually are from an album called The Good Old Days, which was found during the Treblinka trials in the 60s and 70s. And these photographs were taken by the man who was later to become the camp commandant. And they show several things. One of the most daunting photos, I think, from this album that I find is that one of the actual zoo in Treblinka.
There was a zoo here,
and it's really hard to comprehend how
they just had wild animals here from the forest.
They collected animals and they put them in the zoo, which was near the reception area. So all these victims who would walk into the gas chambers would walk past the zoo in the SS living quarters every day.
The fact that so many Jews died at Treblinka and there's no physical evidence continues to dog the history of the camp. Those who deny the Holocaust say instead it was a transit camp, that it was impossible to kill hundreds of thousands of people and dispose of their bodies. That desire to hide the truth dates back to 1943 and the Nazis themselves. Dr. Yitzhak Arad again.
In the beginning, bodies were buried in big pits in the extermination area. But Himmler was in charge of the whole operation. When he spoke about the extermination of the Jews, he said, it is a page of glory in German history, but it should never be written. I personally think that he quarted in 1942, after the German failure to conquer Moscow, he started to feel that maybe Germany is going to lose the war. Therefore, all the traces of the extermination should be erased. And actually, he established a special commando. They were ordered to open the pits in the occupied territories of the Soviet Union and burn the bodies so no traces were left. He wanted the whole extermination of Jews would remain undiscovered and a secret.
And in his memoir, Chil Rackman remembers this change of tactics, as he describes them, when, in January 1943, a new specialist that the Jews nicknamed the Artist arrived at the camp. He was sent there to supervise the exhumation of bodies and the burning of new corpses daily on huge iron grills, 30 metres long. Burning flesh could be smelt for miles around.
From day to day, the work improves. The ovens are moved from place to place, closer to the pits, so that the path is shorter and less time is wasted. It once happened that an oven was moved close to a huge grave where perhaps 250,000 people were buried. As usual, the oven was loaded with the proper number of bodies, and in the evening it was lit. But a strong wind carried the fire over to the huge grave and engulfed it in flames. The blood of some 250,000 people began to flare, and thus burned for a night and day. The whole camp administration came to look upon this marvel, gazing with satisfaction at the blaze. The blood came to the surface and burned as if it were fuel.
Oh, that's heavy. It's a big iron lid, and there are lots of them, and underneath people have left candles to remember their relatives who died. Just put it down. So heavy, this thing. And there are a whole load of them. There are about 20 of these big iron lids covering pots around a big cremation pit. And there's a memorial here too of lots of burned wood in a pit to remind people of the huge funeral pyres that the Germans would have built in order to burn thousands of bodies at a time.
The effect of burying something in the ground can either boost plant growth or it can limit it. And we're seeing a lot on this particular site that there are areas where very little grows at all, and the kind of plants that do grow don't have any roots. They just sit on the surface. So we can tell straight away just by looking that there's going to be something buried under there that's affecting the actual vegetation.
So that means there's something under here which is preventing vegetation being rooted?
Essentially, yes. And also, if you imagine that what the Germans were doing was mixing the ashes of the victims with the very sandy geology in this area and then putting it back into the earlier graves, then obviously that kind of combination of burnt soil, burnt sand, ashes all together is not a very nice environment for plants to grow, and nothing has re-established itself since the war.
Well, let's walk on and see what else we can see in this forest area then. And again, there's almost a pit over there. You can see the indentation in the ground.
There is, yes, and there are lots of these dotted around this area of woodland. And this is where, a little bit further in, we have seen local families laying candles.
So they obviously think there's something here.
They do. I think it's common knowledge that this part was the death camp, and that largely the parts that contain the graves are now in this area of forest. And we have actually been urged by a few visitors who've come here to look in the forest and not just be drawn to the open area there, which we will follow up on.
The heavy silence here is disturbed only by the occasional visitor. Hafke Forman-Raban is an elderly Israeli woman originally from Poland. She's surrounded by her children and her grandchildren. She tells me why they've all made the long journey to Treblinka.
My father was the first victim here with 300,000 Jews from Warsaw.
He was deported from the Warsaw ghetto?
Yes.
And do you know precisely what happened to him, or is that difficult to...
I was here, not in the camp, but I was a carrier in the underground. So we heard about this place, but we were not sure what happened here. So I was sent to see. I didn't come in, but people around, you know, Polish people, they knew exactly that the train, many, many trains came here and go back empty.
And so you reported that back to the underground, did you? You took that information back?
I was active until December 42. Then I was arrested, and I was in prison. After this, in Auschwitz, 2 years.
You survived 2 years in Auschwitz? Yeah.
More than. I survived.
And how old was your father when he died in Treblinka?
I think, 50, near 50. There are some people who survived from Birkenau, from Auschwitz, but here not. Here they bring the people only to kill them.
Treblinka needs to be remembered not just as a site of slaughter, but also as the place where Jews said no more. In August 1943, a group of Treblinka's Jewish prisoners rose up against their German captors and the Ukrainian guards. They stole weapons and set fire to the camp. Kalman Tegman was one of the few to come out of the rebellion alive.
We wandered around in forests. We built a bunker in the forest. We made sure we weren't caught. There were Ukrainians there who were in platoons, and they telephoned each other to say that Jews were firing and had taken weapons and were burning the camp. So the Germans knew that something had happened. They could not have imagined such a thing.
Could I ask you, Carmen, you spend a lot of time these days obviously thinking about what went on in Treblinka, what you suffered, what your family suffered. Can you make any sense of it at all?
It makes no sense, and I have no understanding of it. There was a madman, Hitler, and he decided that all of the troubles he had were due to the Jews. So he decided to exterminate them. Look, when the women came with little children, they went into a hut and they had to undress. But there were mothers who had babies who could not walk, who could not talk, little children. So the mothers threw them under the heaps of clothing so that they might stay alive. They did not know what would happen. And the group that went inside afterwards to clean and remove everything from the hut found the children. And these children, the Germans said to exterminate them. So how can you take a baby who cannot walk and exterminate it? They killed the children there and threw them on the fire.
We're looking at two main maps here, one that shows the contemporary image of the site with all of the features that we found during the survey mapped onto it, and one that shows a contemporary aerial image that has also got the features on showing the...
More than a year on from my trip to Treblinka, and Caroline has finished compiling her findings at the University of Birmingham.
All the history books state that Treblinka was destroyed by the Nazis, and in summary, the surveys demonstrated that simply isn't the case. I've identified a number of buried pits using geophysical techniques. These are considerable. One in particular is 26 metres by 17 metres.
That's huge.
It is huge. So we're talking a considerable number of bodies could have been contained within pits of that size.
I mean, that could contain hundreds, perhaps thousands of bodies. We don't know how deep it is, or do you know how deep it is?
Unfortunately, no. The survey technology doesn't allow us to go to certain depths. I know that it's over 4 metres. That was the extent
over
of the
over 4 metres deep?
Yes. It's a considerable pit.
And quite a few pits that you've discovered.
Absolutely. There are a number of pits in particular to the rear of what is now the current memorial, 5 that are actually in a row, again of a considerable size, in an area where witnesses state this was the main body disposal area. This is behind the gas chambers. It was where the majority of victims who were sent there were then subsequently buried, and later where the cremated remains of victims were also placed.
It's not just pits that you found. There are also what looked like buildings.
There are, and again, the Nazis claim that they destroyed Treblinka. They certainly levelled the site, but it's not really possible when buildings have been on a site to actually sterilise the ground. So what I've identified is that solid structural remains, so we're talking building foundations, do survive. But in particular, two sort of structures that I've identified are likely to be the old and new gas chambers at Treblinka.
Does your work have implications for other mass burial sites in Poland and elsewhere?
I think so. It's not just about demonstrating what exists at Treblinka. It's very much hope that the results show the potential for these methods, particularly with regards to Jewish sites where these methods can be taken, they can be utilised at isolated execution sites, for example, at mass graves in Jewish cemeteries where the Nazis rounded up whole villages and executed them. A lot of those sites aren't museums, they aren't marked, they aren't commemorated. And I really hope this is the first stage, if you like, in a long-term programme to seek out these hidden graves of the Holocaust.
And Poland's chief rabbi, Michael Szudryk, agrees that the implications are immense, opening up a whole new area of research on the Holocaust, allowing more mass graves to be located and the victims remembered.
I have no question that once we see that this method works, is that absolutely can be used, because not only did the German Nazis build all six death camps on the territory of occupied Poland, but there are also hundreds of smaller mass graves where Germans caught Jews escaping, hiding, and they were shot and then buried there. And we are discovering, really, just in the last couple of years, how many of these mass graves are still unmarked today. The murdered cannot testify. The murderers are not testifying. But you have bystanders. I sat yesterday in Dinów, and I met with an elderly Polish person who was 14 in August 42, just now, when the Nazis sent off the last Jews. And he described how some of the Jews were taken into the synagogue, and then they burnt the synagogue, and the Jews were jumping out of the windows, and they were shooting them, and then they were buried over there, with pointing his finger, in that gully over there. And there they lie. And some were exhumated later, but he says, we know that they didn't exhumate everything. They're still there. That was yesterday.
Caroline Sturdy-Coles has presented her findings to the authorities responsible for the memorial at Treblinka, and there are many plans now being discussed for altering the site in the future. Changes to the camp boundary, excavations of the buildings, but perhaps above all, marking out those mass graves so visitors won't disturb them and relatives can mourn. The Nazis wanted to cover up their crimes, but nearly 70 years later, the latest technology has caught up with them, helping the act of remembering long after the last survivor will no longer be with us.
Yes, I remained alive and find myself among free people. But why, I often ask myself. Is it so that I might tell the world about the millions of innocent murdered victims? To be a witness to the innocent blood that was spilled by the hands of the murderers? Yes. I remained alive to bear witness against the slaughterhouse of Treblinka.
The Hidden Graves of the Holocaust was presented by Jonathan Charles and produced by Simon Jacobs. It was a unique production for BBC Radio 4.